360 Yourself is a dedicated podcast meeting brilliant minds and looking at the world around them. How do they 360 themselves and 360 the world? Jamie Neal, the host, that's me, asks many questions about their mindset and how they fundamentally operate their world and the world around them. Hello and welcome back to 360 Yourself. I hope you're doing well. I have a brilliant stage designer for you today. I've got John. Hey, John, how you doing?
Hi, Jamie. I'm good, thanks.
Good. Whereabouts are you talking from today? Whereabouts are you based?
I'm in London. I'm in East London, in Dalston, just around the corner from the old Arcola Theatre on Arcola Street. I'm in my, well, very, very new since lockdown, studio and flat. And, yeah, I'm kind of just looking at the kind of grey clouds over my head.
I used to literally live on Shoreditch High Street, and I always used to come to Dalston, and there's a really by the theatre, there's a really well-known sandwich cafe thing that people used to sit outside. I can't remember what it's called now.
Not a Turkish cafe, not Mangal.
No, it's just up the road from the theatre, and then you go kind of behind the buildings, and there's a block of like studio flats and stuff that people like creatives like hire them and stuff, and then it's got seats outside.
I think you mean Hackney Down Studios,
Studios, and there's like a cafe thing underneath it, and they do like
exactly,
really big portions.
There's a rehearsal room there, and there's a really cool coffee shop.
Yeah,
it's a little on the hipster side, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's very like vegan, hipster friendly, and all that sort of thing. But I really, really, I love the vibe of it because the food is also quite fresh as well. And I tend to, when I say, let's meet in Dalston, everyone always kind of recommends that place. So I'm like, I know Dalston quite well. But it's a good place to be going because obviously you're quite close to Victoria Park if you need to have a walk and that sort of thing.
It's an amazing place. I mean, like, I actually moved here first time like 20 years ago, I'd say, and then was involved with Mehmet working in the kind of early days of the Arcola when it was on Arcola Street, and it was a completely different area. I mean, I loved it dearly, and that's kind of why I ended up coming back recently, because it was, I haven't really lived in this area again for 10, 12 years, so it's nice to be back. You've got the kind of Hackney Marshes, as you say, within kind of running distance. So that's one of the first things I do in the morning is run to Hackney Marshes and back, and you can have a walk around the parks. And there's a kind of really nice vibey kind of life around of a kind of interesting kind of cooking pot of kind of all sorts of different culture going on.
Mm-hmm. So I read that you studied at Exeter College of Art. Are you originally from the Southwest, or are you originally from somewhere else?
No, I had quite a varied education actually, because I actually grew up in Warwickshire in the Midlands, kind of near Coventry, born in Coventry, and then kind of grew up, went to school in that area, and then I was really privileged enough to have a music scholarship which paid for a really good education, and it took me down to London to train at the Royal Academy as a musician, and then kind of eventually I kind of sidestepped a music career really to go into kind of what my kind of main ambition, which was to be an artist of some kind, a fine artist of some kind. I went to Exeter College of Art and was a painter. And it was there, really, that I kind of was pointed quite firmly in the direction of being a theatre designer.
It's quite interesting. So how did you, because obviously you had a knack and a skill for the music and that sort of thing, but how did you know, obviously you knew your passion was kind of the fine art and that kind of area, but if you were really, very good in the music area, which is a lot of people say don't follow your passion, follow what you're really good at, and then you'll get really passionate about that sort of thing. What, how did you know that that wasn't the right route for you and you needed to go into a different area?
I didn't know it was the wrong route. I suppose I've used it. I mean, literally my whole family have kind of grown up on education paid for by scholarship, I suppose. And I think my sisters are both professional musicians, and I was destined to do it, but because it had effectively become very much the financial means of paying for an education, it meant that I think in an honest way, it had taken out the kind of fun of it and the real enthusiasm for it. And I kind of saw it for what it was. I'm quite a self-critical person. I mean, I'm kind of a bit of a perfectionist, and I just didn't feel like I was the best, or I was at the kind of best at it. There were many better people around me. And I'm also one of these people that kind of is kind of a bit stubborn and tenacious and kind of ambitious in that respect. And I took a punt on it. I didn't know it was going to work for me, but I kind of went, I want to do something that I firmly believe in. And it felt like, I think in the end, the kind of thing that solved it for me was that I'd been a painter at school and an artist and doing music. And then while I was at school, I was in a school play playing Prince Hal in Henry IV Part II. And there was a casting director in there from the Royal Shakespeare Company. I think he had a son at the school or something. And effectively, I was asked to go and audition. And to cut a long story short, got a role as Lucius in Stephen Pimlott's production of Julius Caesar.
Oh, wow.
Like in 1991 at the RSC, which is amazing. Mm. I'd literally never been to the theatre. I mean, we went once with school, and my mum took me once, but the best tickets we could afford were like right at the back. And there were, in those days, that was a long way up. It wasn't like the kind of intimate experience you get now and in that theatre. And I thought, wow, this place is amazing. I don't know what it is, but it's incredible. I mean, being able to act there or try to act there was, and be on this kind of, in the middle of this creative world and meet this designer called Tobias Hoheisel, who is this kind of crazy German designer that designed, I think, the whole season, but this epic environment he created for the play, and I was in the middle of it, and I was blown away. I was like, I don't really know what this job is, but it really stayed with me. And then when a teacher suggested it to me when I was studying fine arts, I think trying to be a painter, he went, I think you'll work with space and your interest in space, etc. Kind of, it looks like you would be interested in being a theatre designer. And I've seen on your CV that you had some kind of experience in it. And would that be a line, an avenue that you'd be interested in pursuing? And I was suddenly like, of course, that kind of makes total sense. So it became a kind of natural avenue to kind of go down, but it took a long time to get there,
but,
I suppose, ultimately.
But
it was a real gamble. Yeah.
But as they say, though, the universe, if you believe the law of attraction or whatever, maybe subconsciously or consciously, you really wanted to go in that area, and then somehow this artist came into your life and then gave you this opportunity, and then you were like, well, yeah, I'm going to take this opportunity because that's what I want to do. And you would maybe you would have found the thing that you really want to do, which is obviously stage design and creative direction, maybe later on in life, but the universe and life actually put that into place early on in your life and for a reason for you to go in that avenue.
Totally. And I'm like you, a massive believer in that. I mean, I think we're privileged enough to be in that position to be able to be shown those things. But I think I think it takes a lot of kind of determination still to kind of pursue it or at least see it. Mm. But yeah, it was a definite kind of perfect formation of a number of things that just kind of came together at that one moment for me to take it. So yeah, I totally agree with that.
And so when you came out of kind of your graduating year, you were finalist at the Limbury Prize, which is a brilliant, I mean, if people don't know, it's a brilliant, amazing achievement to have. How did you kind of navigate in the industry, like when you first started? Did you know that you wanted to, could you go across theatre, dance and opera and other kind of avenues? Did you know you wanted to do that sort of wide scale of work, or was it just kind of gradually getting your feet into different doors and trying different things?
Yeah, I think it was more of a kind of scramble at the beginning, I suppose. It's such a hard profession that I think it's a kind of survival of the fittest sometimes, I think, you know, and it's overly competitive, and I think that's one of the things that needs to change. It's sometimes it really doesn't allow room for the kind of the real talent to kind of pop up. But I think at the beginning it was just a really hard slog, to be honest. I mean, I was totally skint. I was living off baked beans. I ended up kind of squatting in the Arcola, which became essentially my bedroom essentially became a kind of dressing room at one point for the theatre itself. And I was kind of surviving on nothing and taking whatever I could get. The Limbury Prize was like a massive, it's an incredible opportunity. It's a really good kind of advertisement for your work, I suppose, because you're whittled down to kind of these 12 finalists who essentially are the creme de la creme of kind of graduating theatre design. But it didn't mean that the jobs kind of just came flooding through the gates. It everything was hard work, and I think at the beginning I just took everything I could. I was building and designing most of the Arcola shows between myself and a designer called Miriam Buta, and who's now an incredible designer, and I was also then taking whatever kind of came along. And there were kind of moments of like kind of marriage bureau-y kind of things where people were put together, and I met a choreographer, Kathy Marston, who was on a kind of an associate attachment to the Royal Opera House, and I met a couple of interesting other people at the time who became essentially long-term collaborators. But at the time, I was just kind of doing anything I could. I wasn't deliberately kind of following a path. I was just kind of doing whatever it was. Whoever would give me 50 quid, really, to be honest.
Yeah. at what point in your career, because obviously when you first start, you generally take a lot, whatever you can, to build a CV.
Yeah,
what point in your career was you then saying, actually, I'm going to really specifically go to the areas, one, that I'm interested in, been working in, but two, people that I really generally like working with, and three, this is kind of the career that I want to build, rather than being so sporadic, because at some point you kind of need to fine-tune exactly what who you are as a person, what you want to say as an artist, and where you want to say it.
Totally, but I think that requires, I think it took a long time for me to get there, really, because I think it, again, it pays so little. I mean, you know how little the profession often pays, particularly designers, is that you have to do a lot of work to survive, to just pay the rent, never mind, you know, getting to the point where you can afford an assistant or whatever, you know, to employ an assistant, etc. So I was really living hand to mouth for a surprisingly long, long time, and I think sometimes when I say that to people, they're a bit in shock. But it's a complicated profession to work within that's not paid particularly well. And I think to find that privileged place where I could actually start to kind of focus on the real things that I wanted to do, it took an incredible amount of time. I wish I'd been more self-critical, more critical, more of what I took, I suppose. I kind of maybe took too much at times and I was overloaded, but at the same time I think that also develops a style and an ability to move quickly and have a kind of distillation process within your style and your process of working that means you can actually you get better at what you do quicker, and you're able to do things when you get to kind of doing these massive shows like say the Paralympics and stuff. You're able to make a lot quicker decisions that you're not having to go through an entire process because it's been rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and fine-tuned because you've got such a little amount of time to work with it.
And as they say, the fee that you usually get as an artist is not, even if you do it over, even if it's a day's fee and it's a whacking great fee, it's like you're not paying me for that day, you're paying me for X amount of years that I've been grafting and fine-tuning my skill. And that's why I always say to people, it's like if I chart my agent charges a certain thing, it's because I've been doing it for a long time and I've worked with different people and I've got a lot of information and advice and skills from other different people that's created my toolbox. And it's
and it's not totally yeah,
whether,
yeah.
Whether,
and it's not an hourly rate, is it? It's not you can't kind of monetize what we do because everyone takes a certain amount of time to do it. And the trouble is it's all consuming, and maybe that's a problem sometimes, is that we think about it when we're in the shower, you go for a run, you're thinking about it, you're eating your lunch, thinking about it, you're at dinner, you're talking to your partner, or, you know, you're with your mates, kind of all, and it's always there, it's always part of the conversation.
Mm, mm.
So, and it's not something you charge, you don't charge for that.
Yeah, yeah. And so being a very keen visionary of working across multiple platforms, so working on, for instance, Bat Out of Hell, and working on Bugsy Malone and the Paralympics, you have to be open to so many different ideas that people are suggesting. But also, life is also throwing suggestions at you and influences. And so how do you kind of get your inspiration, or how do you kind of find your zen moment to think about ideas, or where do you kind of start from?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I think it's really worth remembering that what we do is a collaborative art, for a start. I think one of the reasons, in hindsight, I think I took this avenue and wasn't interested in being, say, a painter or a cellist, you know, a single person performer or artist, is that you're constantly working and having conversation with others, and effectively, and others of different craft, another skill base, another interest in aesthetics and creed. And I think it provides a kind of a constant dialogue that you're constantly evolving your ideas through. And I think that is one of the things that interests me most about this profession. And I think the other thing is it's a kind of improvisatory profession. I think we are constantly on our feet changing things and reworking things. And I think it's live. That's the whole point of it. It's like we're making it up as we go along, kind of thing, or telling our story live around that kind of campfire, and building on that as a live event. And I think it's rare, honestly, that I sit down purely on my own. I mean, I have my studio practice where I get time to sit at my desk and work, and it's quite a kind of silent space, even when there's lots of people here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the only true time, weirdly, the only true time I get with my own thoughts is either in the shower and on a run or on the tube.
Mm-hmm.
In the days that we did go on the tube, it's actually those kind of small snippets of time that I get kind of get most of those ideas, I suppose, and formulate those ideas.
Would you say that you, within your work and within your profession, that you lead with your logic, or would you lead with your emotion?
I think I lead with my instincts. So it's more emotional, I suppose, than logic. I think logic forms the second part of that, but I think I go with a gut instinct to start off with that I don't think often you can put into words. You don't think there's any reasoning behind it. It's just something that appears and hovers, and you kind of snatch it. And at that point, you start reworking it like a big kind of crazy ball of clay into something that you are channeling it down into the thing that it becomes.
Obviously, life is kind of like a roller coaster, as they say in that famous song. I don't know, life is like a roller coaster. And what we do as creatives is emotional, because, or is emotive, because we are putting ourselves into our work. And because the freelance life and creativity and the process can be ups and downs, how do you, when you're in your kind of darker times, how do you kind of manage that when you are, say, in the process of a project, or you're thinking of ideas if you're not in a job? How do you navigate between the two kind of worlds when you are in that kind of fluctuating space?
I think I've got a lot better at navigating. I think in the early days, and until fairly recently, I suppose, I've been a tremendous workaholic, and I think I've not allowed myself downtime, and I've not allowed myself kind of mental healing time to really kind of look after myself in that process. But I do think you hit, as any creative does, hit dark times, whether it's the kind of post-show kind of bluesy kind of feeling that we all get, after we've accomplished something or done something, and all that energy that we've been striving towards has kind of been expelled, or the kind of moments where you don't have any inspiration, or you feel like you're the kind of worst at what you do, which kind of comes to me almost on a kind of monthly basis sometimes. I think the times like that, I think with experience, I suppose the way I've kind of found ways to deal with it is things like exercise. It's taken me a long time to realise it, and people say it all the time, but I'm a quite a self-conscious person at times, and even the idea of running outdoors amongst people sometimes was quite a horrible, frightening kind of thought, to be honest. But actually kind of doing it, like I took a neighbour out yesterday for his first run, and he said, "I'm just frightened." He said afterwards, he didn't want to go over it, but after about 10 minutes, he said, I've done my bit, you carry on, and I carried on for another 8 kilometres or whatever. But he said afterwards, it was just exhilarating and amazing just to get out there, because he said the thing was, it was the fear of going out. He was just scared of actually going out and being seen, or being going out and running, etc. And I think, although I'm going on a diatribe here, but it feels like it's important to kind of acknowledge that it's, people say it, but it's actually a really beneficial way of countering those kind of dark times is exercise. I think seeing your friends, having conversations that don't necessarily revolve around theatre. I think we all, in the performing arts kind of world, we get in danger of kind of living within a bubble and talking in a kind of echo chamber to our friends, etc., and kind of G-ing each other up on our on the kind of almost competitive conversation that I don't think is healthy. And I think a lot of my closest friends are not in theatre. I mean, I enjoy hanging out with people who really just don't watch it, to be honest, because it's healthy, because they can challenge my ideas, they can challenge my thoughts and philosophy, but they can also talk to me. We can also have conversation about things completely differently about other things in the world.
Yeah,
which is exciting and interesting.
When you were younger, did you have a strong kind of mental approach, or did you, as you came into the industry, did your mental health change in some way compared to when you're younger, when you did have maybe as much stress and that sort of thing?
I think I've always been a stressed person. I think honestly, because I've always been essentially using music effectively to pay for an education, I was having to perform to a high level, and I think it created a tremendous amount of anxiety at a younger age. Now I look back at it, and I don't think it was very healthy. And I think, but that was the kind of adrenaline levels we were living on, and we were running between orchestra practices and schools and whatever, and seeing friends, and that kind of high anxiety level of living, you know, it was kind of grabbing food while driving, you know, your mum's driving you in a car somewhere and you're eating on the way, and all of that was like always high anxiety level. So that was a kind of norm for me, and it took a long time for me to realize that was a kind of norm, like that shouldn't be normal level. And I was living at a kind of 140% constantly, and it took a long time of kind of working that down, but that was in slow steps. I don't think I was good at it. Well, I definitely wasn't good at the beginning. And I was kind of tearing around London, you know, occasionally getting knocked off your bike because you were just, it's constantly kind of rushing. And I think London also does that to you, that kind of, that mental kind of the drug of the city. And sometimes I think it's useful to acknowledge that might not be the right way to achieve things fast and furiously. I think why not take some more time to really kind of engage with what's around you and really have time to think about. I mean, one of the most amazing things about this kind of enforced, I mean, frightening time, but it's enforced kind of hiatus we've all experienced, is that we've all had a kind of collective experience where we've had time to really think about what we have here and the privileges we have and the responsibility we have to change things in the future and really, really kind of analyze what it is we've been living through. And I think one of the things, if we could take it from this moment now, like right now, the post-COVID or mid-COVID, is to really take time to listen to the world, to each other, to our friends, to ourselves, to our families, and care. rather than kind of be competing and kind of have this kind of dog eat dog kind of mentality to our living and our climate attempts to kind of climb up a ladder of industry, which I don't think ultimately does anything other than kind of constantly create a never-ending kind of echo chamber of the same kind of privileges and same kind of system problems that have existed for it from day one kind of thing.
I totally agree. I think over this period for me is the reflective moment of what is your purpose. For me, that's been the biggest thing of like, what am I trying to do in my space? Yes, you can work for different people, and it's great to work with people that you've always wanted to work with, and brands and all that sort of thing. But actually, are you giving impact to the people that are around you? And what is your purpose? Is it something higher? And I think that's been a great thing, and also a sad thing in this moment in time, that we are all connected into that whole kind of perspective of reflectiveness and to be better and to be more mindful. And what I found over talking to people before the lockdown and in the lockdown on this podcast is that sort of understanding of I don't know, just being more mindful of that, the world around them. And I think that's what we try to, what I try to do and also speak to people on this podcast is actually look into yourself deeper as a person to reflect outwards. You can never be happy if you try to claw for things outwards. It all starts from inwards. And we have to learn how to love ourselves inward and to understand ourselves inward before we can then push out all the love and great energy that people are attracted to. It's this whole thing about success is also never ending, because I don't know about you but I'm highly driven love success and very ambitious, but it gets to a point of going, okay, so when is enough, when is content? I was speaking to another person, Duncan Stewart, who's a casting director in Broadway, and he was on the podcast a couple of months ago. And we're very, very similar people, because once we've achieved something, we're on to the next thing, because we're seeing the bigger picture. We're like, okay, so this is where I want to get to. But actually, it's about finding the recognition in the small things, but also going, if that bigger picture is obtainable, and when you do achieve it, what happens then?
Exactly. Yeah, because it's a never-ending pyramid, is it? It's a thing you're constantly climbing, and it'll never stop. And it, like a drug, I think you're right. I think the important thing is to try and remain true to yourself, but to your goals, but true to what you're trying to find within those goals. I think ultimately, and that changes. You need time to reflect on that. You know, you need time to realize what that thing is. It's not always obvious, I'd say, and I think you need time to kind of to find that truth. But as you say, look around, you have a chance. I mean, it's funny, until years later, I never got a chance to really reflect on, for instance, the Paralympic Games, which is such a monumental moment in my life, and kind of an amazing time, not only of kind of things achieved, but also kind of the impact of that, what we did within the games, within those opening ceremonies, particularly in the Paralympics, for diversity and disability within a kind of wider world. And I never really, I think at the time I was moving so quickly post it that I only had time to be self-critical and critical really of what I'd created and my side of the things. It was so egotistical and kind of myopic in kind of its inward introspection, rather than actually thinking about how incredible it was to see all of that kind of talent and tenacity kind of creating, and determination, I suppose, creating what we created, what we managed to put out there and show to the world. And I think that was the point of it. It wasn't like, oh, how good did my piece of scenery at that point look like? Could I have done a better job of it? That was just not the point.
It's about the bigger message.
Kind of really acknowledge that.
Yeah, it was about the bigger message, because it doesn't matter. Well, it does to a certain extent matter about the creative art that's gone into it, but it's about the wider thing. about how why we're doing it and what's the message that we're trying to push into the universe, into the community. Because we're obviously we're different when we are in our early 20s and teenage years, because we're wanting to succeed and all that sort of thing, and then we get to a point that you are in quote successful, whatever success means for you, and you to a certain point you have to be so ambitious to accomplish anything. You have to especially to your feet and where you are at this moment, you have to be hungry and wanting to be better yourself every single day, and you've done a lot of work between kind of here in the US. Have you ever thought about moving and pushing the boundaries and going further, and or are you very set and you've changed your mindset now and go, okay, well, I'm in this place now where I really, really like, do I need to go to that point, or has your hunger softened slightly a bit over time, or are you still as hungry as ever as since you were 20?
I think my hunger's changed. I think I'm more interested in doing, I mean, I'm much more interested in doing more with other people, and as in kind of the training of other people and younger kind of assistants, etc., and the training of graduates, and kind of fulfilling their dreams to a certain extent and making them better than I would ever be, and kind of pushing them further up, and to change what we do in performance and theatre, and to change this industry, which I think is full of its issues, as we're all aware. And I think my, but I'm not sure necessarily my ambition has changed, but I think I'm aware that I don't need this. Climbing higher is not necessarily better. I think it's understanding that a kind of sideways travel is equally, or downwards travel to a certain extent, is equally as effective and as compelling and ultimately rewarding, I suppose. I've never seen America, for instance, or the US as a kind of a place to be. I mean, I've toyed with the idea of going there for a while, but I never saw it as needing to go there, really, to be honest. I think we, in this country, with it, although we, despite massive issues politically, I think we have an incredible kind of a kind of cosmopolitan kind of melting pot of ideas and kind of aesthetic and creativity that I think is second to nowhere else. And I enjoy being part of that kind of European tradition. And I enjoy going as much to Japan, to be honest, as I do it as enjoy going to America, as enjoy going to New York or LA. I think I've enjoyed my travel. I've enjoyed a lot more of international travel, which obviously is complicated in terms of carbon emission, etc. And I think we need to think about that. But I think I've enjoyed my conversation with other culture, particularly my work in Japan recently. And would love to do more of that, to kind of really engage with other tradition and have that inform my kind of cultural perspective. And I think it's less about kind of achieving these one-off kind of pop events, effectively, that kind of you feel like, oh wow, it's great that I've done that or worked with these people, etc. I think I'm less interested in that to a certain extent nowadays.
Well. Our brains are always moving forward, and we're always growing. And if you're not growing, that's a bit of a problem. And it's great.
Absolutely.
And it's great that you've reflected on the things that you want to do now, and the things that maybe climbing the ladder wasn't the thing that you really want to do, and you've took a sidestep, and that's also great, and that's part of your journey.
Yeah, I think it's important that we all acknowledge to a certain extent that we have to change what exists at the moment. Obviously the world needs to change. We, you know, there's a lot telling us that at the moment, but also the industry that we work in is, you know, live event is like the eighth biggest contributor to kind of CO2 emissions in the world. Like on a yearly basis, it's bonkers. Like with the amount of things we throw out in a kind of pseudo kind of environmentally friendly industry is insane. It's just not sustainable. And I think we need to rethink and reevaluate all of that. And I think that there's an exciting challenge there to be taken. I don't think it's a kind of, oh, we need to give up our ambition to change that. I think our ambition, that can be involved with our ambition, and it's refocusing the lens, I think. And I think that's kind of what I mean by sidestep, is that sometimes I think we've lived in a very individualistic kind of bubble for a long time. I'm definitely one of those people that have done that. And it's been a kind of time of me, but I wonder whether it needs to now be the time of we.
Yes.
And working together. And I don't think that's any, in fact, that's a greater cause, I think, than anything that we would have ever achieved individually.
Mm. I agree. But about educating other younger designers to become brilliant and sometimes better than yourself or what you were at that age, what would be the biggest kind of quote that you've always kind of remembered or you might have learned previously that you would kind of give to those younger designers or anyone else who's listened to the podcast?
I think it's an interesting one. I'd say to myself and say to other, I might make this a number of quotes, but I think the first thing I'd say to myself and the little version of me, and the young designer out there, I'd say just stop and breathe, look around you. I don't think I ever did enough of it. I don't think I ever really stopped. And I think it's only now that I'm learning a lot more very quickly, which has been kind of stored there waiting in kind of hiatus for me to understand it. And I'd say I'd say to everybody, I suppose, and to every designer out there, there's no model for this time. There's no moment. There's nothing to base this on. This is all new. We've got a lot to create here, and it's like starting again in a way. Everything's like starting afresh, and there's always an exhilaration about opening, you know, start having an open model box that's got nothing in it and knowing how to put the first thing in there. But that first bit of exhilarating moment where you first put something in there and the kind of synapses that fire, etc., from that is the most exciting thing. And it's just going, well, actually, that is the most exciting thing. So let's acknowledge that. This is the moment. Let's really find how and really savour that time and this moment and to achieve what I think we can in the future.
Amen to that. We all need to come together to achieve what we need to, what we envision for the future. That's what it is, coming together.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for giving me your time. It's been really, really insightful to just pick your brain and just know what you're thinking. Because obviously, I find this fascinating. Just really, you only see someone's CV and what they've done, but I'm really fascinated to know how they think and how their journey has become and where they've come from and how they've developed from point A to point B. And I always find it's fascinating to get to know creatives who I admire and the work I've seen over the years. So I want to say thank you for giving me your time.
Well, thanks, Jamie. It's been a real pleasure.
No worries. Thank you so much.
All right. See you soon. Thank you.
This is 360 Yourself, and I'm Jamie Neal. Thank you very much for taking a moment to listen to our wonderful guests. Please subscribe to our podcast to access all our brilliant guest episodes. They are released every Sunday at 12 p.m. We are available on all listening platforms, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Overcast, Google Podcasts, and Castro. You can also find us on Instagram at 360_yourself, Twitter at yourself360, and our host at Jamie Neal JN. Thank you for listening.